Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Ujjupatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Iyaya Patipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Samichi Patipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Yaditam Chatavi Purisayukani Atta Purisapugala Esa Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Ahuneo Pahuneo Dakineo Anjali Karaneo Anuttaram Punyaketam Lokasa Tamahang Sangam Abhipujayami Tamahang Sangam Sirasa Namami.
This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, not busy with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety. May all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, crime abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Very good. Okay, see what questions we have here today. The first question. Dear Ajahn, is there such a thing as destiny? Where we die, who we marry, whether we have children, whether we become monks or nuns. Yes, and you're all going to become monks and nuns. No, of course it's not. We make destiny. Finish the question. Although our activities cause results, could destiny be a factor to shape our lives? No, every moment you have the choice to do this, to do that, to come here, to go there. So there's a lot of stuff going on. So you cannot say that this is your destiny. That's not quite accurate, though, because your destiny, you may not all become monks and nuns, but you're all going to end up in a box. You are destined to die. So the other part of destiny, you don't know what's going to happen next. It's not you're destined to... All my plans, all the things I expected to do in life, didn't happen. I told a few people this, that when I decided to become a monk, it was just after the girlfriend dumped me. So I thought, okay, great opportunity. I always wanted to become a monk. So just become a monk for 1 or 2 years over in Thailand, get enlightened. And come back and start a family. That's what I thought, stupid monk. But it didn't work out that way, as you obviously know. And one part of my earliest memories when I became a monk was that I was ordained as a novice monk, first of all, in Bangkok. I didn't know where Ajahn Chah was, but I know I was in this room in Bangkok and it was really noisy. But at night time, it was pretty peaceful. And I remember used to the first 3 or 4 days, could be 5 nights, I'm not sure, I would wake up in a nightmare every evening for about 3 or 4 days, maybe at 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock in the morning or something. I'd wake up in a nightmare. And you know what my nightmare was? My nightmare was I was a layperson. Honest. And I opened my eyes and saw my robes neatly folded next to my bed. It wasn't a bed, sleeping on the floor on a mat. I made it. I'm a monk. And I closed my eyes and went into a peaceful sleep straight away. That was my nightmare, that I wasn't a monk. And as soon as I saw those robes, I opened my eyes, yeah, I'm a monk, yes! And I went to sleep. Now, those actually, you can't sort of make those things up. That just happened. And that just gave me a very powerful lesson. I realized that, I really want to be a monk. And I told other people, I'm going to be in here forever. Yeah, they all say that. But how many had nightmares of being a layperson? So because of that, when it used to be the case when monks wanted to disrobe, they would never come and talk to me. Because I'd always convince them into staying. So I was just... A really hard-nosed monk. Not really a hard-nosed monk, a hard bottomed monk for that city. Anyway, that's so destiny. Not really destiny, but just because, you know, your journey in life is always changing. You don't know what's going to happen next, but you can always mess around with it and change it. There's a lot of stuff you can do to alter the path of your life to something wiser. Is that all planned out? No. Dear Ajahn Brahm, I'm about to start studying again to pursue an interest in the area I'm working in. However, I question whether I should pursue anything work or study related. Instead, should only focus on seeking the truth. Does everything else increase our attachment? Not everything. It depends what you're doing it for, how old you are, why you're up to more study. You know that sometimes, having done a lot of study in sort of very deep areas, that sometimes I think, is it really worth it doing all that study? And even now, in some of the areas where, you know, I interact with you, teaching meditation, teaching Dhamma, you know, counseling, psychology, all of those areas, that people keep telling me, I'm not quite sure if they're just being nice to me, but I think there's something really important in this. They say that to become a psychologist or even like a nurse or a doctor, whatever it is, they have to do all of those studies at university to get the certificates, to get allowed to practice. But it said all the important, interesting stuff they can get from the temple. But, you know, we don't give certificates. That's our problem. But there's so much which you learn about so many different things of life by getting into understanding the nature of your mind and how it interacts with the body. Kindness, not worrying, learning how to use your brain wisely and not arguing with people. And just there's so much innovation. All of these stuff I've been teaching for years. And so it really works. So because of that, that sometimes you have to study to get your certificate so you can practice. But the most important stuff you will learn sitting on a cushion or on a chair meditating. So it really depends. If you're about to start studying again, you've already started, then fine. Do some study. But actually do it efficiently. Because one thing which, you know, I noticed, if you're reading a book trying to gather information, if you're thinking while you're reading, now you can't actually get much information. Because it's like a sponge. A sponge, you know, you might be doing the dishes, cleaning up or something. If the sponge is really dry, it soaks up so much water. But if that sponge is already really wet, it won't soak up anything. So if your brain is thinking about what you're studying, of course it won't pick up much. But if your mind is very peaceful, silent, it's amazing what it remembers. You can pick up so much. So that's one of the reasons why, if you want to study, develop your mind so it's very, very peaceful. There was this Sri Lankan girl I met years and years and years ago, and she said she learnt her meditation while she was a kid in Sri Lanka somewhere. And you know, she was obviously really good at it, because when she went to one of the universities in Melbourne, I'm trying to sort of make sure I don't say who she is, when she went to one of those universities in Melbourne many years ago, that she was studying medicine, and she would just get the top grades every year. And she hardly ever went to any tutorials or lectures. All she'd do was get out the textbooks, meditate first of all, make her mind really peaceful, and just read them in silence. And she had perfect record. It wasn't a photographic memory. It was a memory which was really purified because, you know, she learned how to stop thinking when she was reading. So she could remember everything. And she said when it came to the exams, or the, you know, just the oral interviews or whatever, she would just make her mind peaceful, read the question, and write the first thing which came into her head, which was always the correct answer. Just the way she was using her brain was just very, very efficient, trained by meditation. When she finished, you know, she never became a doctor. I think she went back to Sri Lanka just to start a little meditation group over there. because she realized that the meditation was far more powerful than anything which she knew from medicine. An interesting story about just how, through the meditation, your studies can really take off. And also, you know, when you're reading a question, you can use your mind to actually to read the mind of the examiner and find out what the right answer is. No, you don't do that. Dear Ajahn, jhanas lead to samadhi, or concentration leads to jhanas. Okay, samadhi, you got concentration. But I don't like that translation of samadhi to be concentration. It's much more accurate to call it stillness. Because all of these words, especially when you get these words of terms like, you know, what happens in in a deep meditations, that once you understand what those deep meditations are, you know, you don't use your etymology, you know, where this comes from. Because sometimes, analyzing a word, sometimes, you know, it doesn't make any sense. For example, you've got the word together. Now, if you analyze that, what it means, if you split it up into its compounds, together, it comes from two, first word, T-O, second word, get, and third, her, to get her. And of course it doesn't mean that, but, you know, you can split it up like that and say, oh, that's what it means. Of course it doesn't. But then you get samadhi. What does it actually mean? Well, how about checking some people, some monks or nuns, lay people who actually do have, you know, samadhi. What is it? And you find it's really, really deep stillness. And as it's defined by the Buddha, it's used so often in the suttas and in the Vinaya as well, the rules for monks and nuns. And it's always defined the same. There's first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. What is samasamadhi? First jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. That's what samadhi is. Samasamadhi, the right samadhi, is always the jhanas. Always, nothing else, ever. So jhanas lead to samasamadhi. Jhanas are samasamadhi. So what happens after the jhanas? Where does samasamadhi lead? And samadhi pachayang yatabhuta yana dasana, said the Buddha many times, which you all know the translation of that, don't you? You know, I had to learn, Latin at school, you know, in England. And Latin was just, I remember on one of the school desks, One of the pupils in the school had carved into the desk years ago the following poem about the Latin language. Latin is a language as dead could be. First it killed the Romans, now it's killing me. But anyway, you had to learn it, and I didn't know why at the time. It must be my destiny, because it made it so much easier to learn Pali, you know, the language of the suttas. So when you learned the Pali, and you read the suttas in Pali, the original language, you read them, and wow, it was so clear. There's all some of these translations. They were a monk practicing with great teachers, forest tradition. It became very clear what these meanings were. You know, for samadhi, it was stillness. I had that cup the other day, just putting the cup down with water. How to get this water still to let it go? Because when things are still, things disappear. And when they disappear, you realize these weren't yours. They're blissful because what's disappearing is a lot of suffering. So free not to have these things. That's why samadhi pachayatabhuta yana dasana, samadhi, stillness, the jhanas, are the cause for seeing things as they truly are. The still forest pool. Only when the pool, the lake, is perfectly still do you see an undistorted, an unbent, an untwisted reflection of the moon and the stars. Only through stillness do you see things as they really are. I'll say more about that tomorrow, because I think I'm going to talk about insight tomorrow. Dear Ajahn, we always ask you questions, but mostly about ourselves and our journey in Buddhism. What about you?
Who?
Okay, I'll just finish. How are you going with it? Do you have any questions that you haven't answered yet, asked yet? What do you want to find out? Okay.
What was that story? It was about a year ago that, and I'm over 68 now. I was born in 51. So somebody said that when you're sort of over, I think even 60 in Australia, you can get like these seniors cards. And they allow you to, you can go cheaply on the buses. Doesn't affect me, because if I want to go anywhere, people say, oh, please, I'll drive you. So it's not used for that. But you can get a free cup of coffee, apparently, in McDonald's with one of these cards. And I don't know what else you can get from them. But I thought, well, you know, other people can get them, so why don't I get one? So I got one just because I could. That's the only reason. So I went online and just typed it all in and said, yeah, okay, you know, you qualify, but we have to prove who you are. So you have to come for an interview in Centrelink. So I made the time for the interview, went in there, and you know, there was a lady sitting opposite the desk and said, you know, we've called you in here because there's this thing called identity fraud. You know, can you please prove who you are? And I looked at her and said, I've been a monk now for almost 44 years. This was about a year ago. For 44 years, I've been trying to answer that question and haven't found an answer yet. And she wasn't amused. She obviously wasn't a Buddhist. So anyway, she said, I want some identification. And I said, what ID have you got? And they said, show me your driver's license. I don't have a driver's license. I haven't driven for 45 years, 50 years. Okay, show me your, what else? Your credit card. Don't have a credit card. Your bank account. Don't have a bank account. Your house agreement, or, you know, your ownership of a house. Don't own any house. Your rental agreement. Don't rent anything. I think I told a story the other day in Nolamara. And they said, well, what about your marriage certificate? And I looked, I said, come on. That's just like when I went through the airport in Perth the other day. I, you know, just do a lot of traveling. And I went through there, and the guy, you know, was saying, no, in your bag, sir, have you got any liquids or gels? No, just the toothpaste. That's all I've got. He said, have you got any hair gel? I looked at him and said, come on. And he laughed, and I laughed. He just sent me straight through. I said, I don't have any of that. And so she looked at me and said, you don't exist. Because you've got no sort of things which the government can link their computer to. I said, you mean I don't exist? The Buddha was right. And she said, stop messing around. And so I got out my passport. Oh, that's good. And I've got two passports. I got my Australian passport and a British passport. And they said, oh, great. He said, we're not really supposed to use two passports, but that's all you've got, fair enough. So I do exist after all. Anyway, so that's the trouble you have with sometimes being monks that just, sometimes you don't fit in. I don't mind. Anyway, dear Ajahn, you have used eating as an analogy to meditation. Ajahn Chah used that. And you said too much food is not good for the body. Can we ever have too much meditation? No. Because why do you eat? You eat gives you a certain amount of energy in the body. Meditation gives you lots and lots of energy. I suppose, thinking about it, yeah, I mean, you can't have too much the meditation where you just sit down and close your eyes. Because it's good also to share it with other beings. to serve. And that is an interesting part which I haven't really focused on yet, the loving kindness, the metta, the giving part of meditation. Because when I was, you know, the early years as a monk, just spending a lot of time by myself, but then after about 3 or 4 years, I started volunteering to do jobs and tasks for others. Because something strange happened when you did not consider your own needs, but you served others. I got much more energy and deeper meditation. I got inspired when I served others. And one of the jobs I did was, you know, I learned how to write and speak Thai language. So I filled out the visa forms for the monks. And then I also took them to Bangkok and got them all stamped. I had their passports and got them stamped to the different embassies. So I did the job of doing the monks' visas for them. And I thought, you know, some of these monks are a bit senior to me, and they went off into the jungles, into the forest to meditate. And I thought, wow, what a wonderful thing it is. I'm helping them with their meditation. You know, they don't have to go to Bangkok, I'll do that for them. And then we'd come back again, they'd have to come back to sign their forms. And a weird thing happened when we started talking about meditation. It was very obvious my meditation was far more advanced than theirs were. And that really shook me for a while. How come when I was, you know, working for them, I wasn't working that hard, but, you know, just doing services for them, and they were having more time to meditate, how come my meditation was deeper? And I couldn't figure it out until I realized that meditation has lots and lots of causes to it. One of those is, you know, your sila, you know, your virtue. Your sila means like your precepts, your goodness. And really good people, they're really so kind, they're generous. And they're generous don't mean like money, you know, of course that is important too. But, you know, that somebody has missed their breakfast and you look to them, you know what they like, and you keep something for them. Just a little act of kindness. There's a little act of kindness because you're not just thinking about yourself, you're thinking of others as well. In other words, caring for the people you live with in your cottage, you know, you get to know each other and you realize, oh, somebody, this, I need a bit of hot water or something, there's no water, you bring some water to them or whatever. Those little acts of kindness, they really get your meditation going. You get a pure heart. And I realize what it is that when you get your nimitta up, people who have just really good minds, pure-hearted beings, we all know some people like that somewhere, and you may be one of those. Just pure-hearted, always giving, never say a bad word about anybody, just always being kind. You know, who's one which comes to mind right now who's not sitting here? Bianca. You know, she does all this. She doesn't get paid. You know, she should be retired meditating, but she does all this hard work for each one of you. What a pure-minded person that is. And so when she meditates, whoa, beautiful mind states, because her mind is pure. So if you have a pure mind state, that really gets the meditation going. So that's why a little bit of service, goodness, kindness, generosity. It may be not your job on the roster to wash up, but someone's sick, so yeah, I'll wash up today. And I tried that once over in Bodhinyana Monastery. I was the abbot there, senior monk. So there wasn't many people washing up, so I went into the kitchen after our lunch and took a tea towel and started washing. Not washing, drying the dishes in the kitchen over at Bodhinyana. And a couple of the Thai people, they took one look at me. They realized I was in the Thai tradition, you can't tell a monk off. So that what they did, they got my tea towel and pulled it away from me. Get up there. That was really funny. I'm just laughing about that. But it is important just to be able to serve and help. And when you do serve and help, you have a beautiful, pure, happy mind. You get deep meditation that way. So it's not just sitting down for hours and hours and hours on your bum. It's also just where you're coming from, the kindness and the joy which you have. Anyway, to Ajahn, is it right for you to depend on someone to forgive, take away the sins? Of course not. What do you want to take away all your bad karma for? It's your karma. It's nice. My old bad karma. It's nice having my bad. You change it. You don't take it away. You change it into good karma. All your bad karma. It's all the fertilizer for your mango tree. It's valuable stuff. So don't get someone to take it away. Where did that idea come from? So you made a mistake. You've done something wrong. You're being selfish, you're being angry, you're being sneaky. You know, and sometimes people think they can get away with all the tricks which they do in this place. Ha, ha, ha. Somebody is watching you. Who is it? You are. Oh, it's lovely. I like telling stories because I get fed up with questions, I must admit. There was this lovely story. It's a Hindu story. It's a bit sort of, you know, set in a long time ago, so please forgive some of this story, but there was a teacher in India a long time ago, had many disciples, but in those days, one teacher would teach the students everything. Now, for maths, you know, the languages, you know, you name it, would teach it to them. But he also had a daughter, and the daughter was drop-dead gorgeous. Wow, she was so, I think the word these days, she was so hot. People tell me these words, I don't know if I'm using them properly. But anyway, so they all just wanted, you know, they'd all fall in love with her, basically. And so one day the teacher called them up and said, now listen, that, you know, I have my daughter and I notice how beautiful she is and how much you all like her. And it is the tradition, you know, that the teacher should marry, if she has any daughters, should marry the daughter to one of his students. But I cannot choose which one I should let marry my beautiful daughter. So I've decided to give you all a test. And the one who wins can marry my daughter. So they're all really excited. Oh, yeah, yeah, what can we do? Is it sort of language test or is it... And he said, I've also had the second problem. The second problem is I'm very poor, don't charge you much. And it's very expensive to have a marriage ceremony and set a couple of people up in a house to make sure that they have enough to look after themselves. So I've decided to check out, you know, who's going to marry my daughter by setting you a test. For the next 7 days, there are no lessons. For the next 7 days, I want you to go into the village, whatever time, probably late at night or early in the morning, and steal as much as you can from the houses. Just make sure that no one sees you, that's all. And whoever steals the most, following my instructions, can marry my daughter. And they're all quite shocked because the teachers are usually really moral. And he asked us to steal. He said, yeah, follow the instructions. Just make sure no one sees you. And so, for the next 7 days, the students, motivated by obedience to their teacher, and also because they really loved this beautiful girl, they would creep into their houses late at night, really quiet. And if they were all asleep, everybody had their eyes closed, they would steal things. And then they'd take them back to the teacher, and the teacher said, what house was that from? What is it? He kept a very clear record. And after 7 days, actually before then, after about 5 days, he called all the students and said, you can stop now. Because you've already stolen so much from the village. It's enough there to keep a family just well supplied with riches and goods for a long time. And they were thinking, who's stolen the most? Who's stolen the most? He said, all of you have stolen very well, except for one of you. And this shy young man in the back put his head down. Come forward. And the shy young man just said, why didn't you steal anything? Why were you disobedient? And he put his head up and said, Master, I was obedient. What do you mean? Said the teacher. Well, said the young student,
I went into the village late at night or really early in the morning. And I crept into the houses, and sometimes the people weren't even there. Sometimes they were fast asleep. And I saw some gold or something valuable, and I went to pick it up. But I remembered your instructions. I could only steal if no one sees me. And the master was really interested. Continue. I thought you said everyone was asleep or no one was there. Who was seeing you steal? And the student said, me. I was seeing me steal. Therefore, I couldn't do it. Sadhu, 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 said the teacher. At least one of my stupid disciples have been listening to my teachings. And you can marry my daughter. And of course, they lived happily ever after, simply because he was a very good boy. You know, how can you steal? There's always somebody watching. Who is that? You're watching. So whatever you have done sneakily, whatever you have done which has broken the precepts, whatever you have done which you shouldn't have done, someone was watching you. You were. So that was a lovely little story, so that's why, you know, doing bad things or doing wrong things or something, you can't say it didn't exist. You did it. You see it. Anyway, so to forgive, take away the sins? No, you don't. You learn from any mistakes. You acknowledge it. Yeah, I did it. You learn from it. Why did you do it? And just, you know, can't you do something better next time? And then thirdly, you let it go. I've already said about the 50 strokes of the teddy bear, 50 strokes of the cat story, but that is epitomizes, you know, why we don't sort of have, like, sins as such or bad behavior. Somebody does something wrong, you made a mistake. Don't do it again, that's all. So nice, that. Ajahn Brahm, the traditional way of doing metta in stock is, may I be happy, etc., for four groups, wanting, craving, rebirth. Wanting, craving leads to rebirth. Your instructions on metta is to bring up the feeling in the heart and resonate it out, starting with the kitten. This is what I've done before. Have previous teachers got it wrong? Yeah, they've all got it wrong. I'm the only one who's got it right. Of course not. It's just you see it from a different way. Oh, there was these two monks having an argument. You've got to believe in rebirth. The Buddha taught rebirth. If you don't believe in rebirth, you know, you can't become enlightened. And the other monk said, how do you know there's rebirth? You can only live in the present moment. All the past is a memory, and sometimes we change our memories to suit our beliefs. And the future hasn't happened yet. Who knows what the future might be? Ooh. Ooh, there's a ghost outside. So we have, you know, they're having an argument. You have to believe in rebirth, or you don't have to believe in rebirth? So one of the monks said, we're going to go and see the teacher. So one of the monks went inside to see the teacher and said, look, the Buddha said that, you know, rebirth is, you know, part of the continuation of things. The Buddha told about his past rebirths. We meditate to get in line so we don't get reborn. And she said, oh, yeah, that's right. And the monk was very happy. He went outside and said, I just went to see the teacher. The teacher said, I was right. He can't have said that, said the other monk. So the other monk went to see the teacher. And he said, how do we know what the past is or the future is? We only got the present moment. And really enlightened beings have to live in the present moment. So rebirth in the future or past lives, that's in the past, that's in the future. That's not important. And the Jesus said, oh, yeah, yeah, that's right. And so the second monk was really happy. And he went out to see the monk he was arguing with. He said, the teacher said I was right. He can't have said that. He said, I was right. So let's go and see the teacher together. So they went to see the teacher together, and one monk first, you know, gave the argument. First, he said, I was right. And secondly, you said he was right. We can't both be right. And the teacher said, yeah, that's right. I love that story, because all these arguments, it's a waste of time. Anyway, so have Peter's teachers got it wrong? No, we both got it right. Or like our meditation methods, people have an inclination to a method and use it, so whatever works. Exactly. Your thoughts will be appreciated. No, they're not appreciating my thoughts. The thoughts just spoil my stillness. Any possibility of doing a guided meditation session before the last day? Of course there is a chance. Not much of one, but there is always a chance. I should have been a politician or used car salesman or something. What are jhanas and stream entry? The difference. One is a deep state of peace. Stream entry is understanding what that means. What are the things we can do to develop right view? Give me a bribe. No, that's wrong view. No, to develop right view. That'll be for tomorrow. I'm talking about insight. Right view, stream winning. Insight is tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock. Ooh, are you excited? No, don't be excited. That's wrong view, being excited. Being insighted. How does one maintain a deep sense of joy knowing the devastating things that happen in the world? Devastating things happen in the world, but whenever there's a tragedy, there's people just rise up to the occasion doing amazing, beautiful things. So, yeah, tragedies, people lose their lives, people get really badly injured, and other people come up and do some amazing, wonderful things. Good example of that, I remember in history, that the Great Fire of London in, what was that, 1660-something? And the Great Fire of London, it burned just most of the central city of London. It was devastating. People lost so much property. It was huge. What happened next? It gave the engineers a chance to put in a sewage system through London. I think it was before they had the fire, they had the plague in there somewhere. People were always dying because the sewage system was disgusting. So it gave them, they had, all the houses were destroyed. Before they could rebuild the houses, they could put in a sewage system. And so the engineers, and one of the most amazing things, I forget who the engineers were, but one of them decided, you know, if you have sewage systems, all the pipes coming in this way, you want to make sure it doesn't clog up. So how can we achieve that? And what they did was look at a leaf. And just the way the veins of a leaf, the angles they actually meet the main vein of the leaf. If you look at the leaves, and they've got no real leaves here, if you go and look at a leaf which has fallen on the ground, look at the veins on that greenery and how they never come like horizontal, right angle into the main vein. They come at an angle. They didn't know exactly why, but they thought that life has been around much longer than London. Trees have been sort of evolving for millions of years. So let's follow that. So they built a sewage system under London following the designs of nature, the way that leaves and plants have things coming together at a certain angle. And of course it worked perfectly for hundreds of years. And I thought that's marvelous when you have sort of a disaster. Sometimes people say, well, you can't undo the disaster, you can't turn back time. We can learn from it and we can grow from it. We can always see some advantages when such things happen. And that's the way we deal with our life. Our world is uncertain. Our world, we do have disasters, plagues and goodness, wars and stuff. So let's learn when we have these things to learn how to do it better next time. I don't mean to fight a better war, but one which doesn't sort of cause so much pain. On an intellectual level, it is obvious that suffering is unavoidable, age, sickness, and death. Why is it so hard to accept the unavoidable of an emotion at an emotional level, i.e. suffering of family member, etc.? Because now we see their pain. I think it scares us when we see somebody else in pain. We think, you know, I'm subject to that as well, especially if someone close to you, and you know, you can't just avoid them and just do something else. You have to keep going to visit them and you see them in pain and suffering. Whenever I see that, it's not just the pain of physical pain and suffering, which I feel sad about, it's just the emotional pain and suffering. Because you see people with the same diseases,
And some people have enormous suffering, but they're at peace with it. There's this one gentleman, many years ago, he used to come over to Dhammaloka Center in Perth and for meditation. And he came one Saturday afternoon to meditate. And I knew him. He used to talk about his problem. He had this really bad back pain. And he said at the time, and no reason to doubt him, he said his back pain was so extreme that he was one of about five or six people here in Western Australia who could take any drug which was available, and even the so-called prohibited narcotic drugs or heroin or something, any drug he could take because the pain was extreme. And it was legal for him. And also he said the people over in the Osborne Park, the medical centre there which was dealing with these problems, he said they'd done some sort of scan or something. They knew what the pain felt like. And they had this scale so he could describe to others how much he was hurting. And he described it to me. His back was just so incredibly painful that he was feeling 24/7. Now that means all the day and night, unless he took the big drugs to knock him out. The pain he was feeling was the same level as if you took a chainsaw and chained his arm off, saw his arm off, without any anaesthetic. So it was really, really painful. But when he came to see me, he had this huge smile on his face. And he said, "I did it. I really did it this time." So what did you do? And I knew what he was sort of up to. I said, "What did you get the ECG flat when you were meditating?" Because you can actually just meditate so peacefully that even just the heart is hardly beating at all. Ajahn Chah used to do that. And he said, no, I did that weeks ago. I've got the EEG flat now. The brain waves were also not discernible at the hospital when he was awake but meditating. And then he turned around and he said, "See all those people in the back? About six or seven of those are doctors from the hospital. They want to find out what the heck is going on with this meditation." So there was a fellow, yeah, incredible pain, but he used it as a spur to meditate. That was his driving force. That's why he was there, to meditate, you know, to actually not to overcome his pain, but to actually to overcome the reaction to the pain. The pain was always there, but now no reaction. He was free. So it's teaching us something. So suffering is our teacher. And sometimes when we learn from it, we learn amazing stuff. I have read in a book that in the first jhana, thoughts can still come in, which is called vitakka vichara. Is it true? Nope. Can you please elaborate on vitakka vichara? These are words, and when I was mentioning about meanings of words like samadhi, every word does not have a meaning. It's only in the context. Sentences have meanings, phrases have meanings, words don't. Have approximate meanings. But to find out what their real meaning is, you have to look at the sentence or the phrase. And the words actually change a little bit, depending on the other words with them. So vitakka vichara does mean thinking and pondering, figuring out where that thought leads to. In some context, but not in the jhanas. And it's only in the first jhana they have vitakka and vichara. It's not thinking. It's totally what we say these days, subverbal. You're not giving anything a name in the jhana. What's happening there is your experience of body has vanished. You're feeling the bliss of just being, really free of having a body. And then that bliss is so strong. You move towards it. That is called the vitakka. The vichara is you're holding on to it. Remember I said putting the cup down? It's like you put the cup down, but you're still holding it. There's a very slight wobble left. That is the vitaka vichara of the first jhana. When you get more confidence, similar to that thing I've been telling a few people, and I mentioned in one of the talks, the three little stages: recognition, familiarity, and ease. Any new place, any new experience, you know, you come up, what the heck was that? And hopefully I've mentioned it somewhere, or you've read about it somewhere, or somebody else has told, oh, you recognize that, that must be that. That was an imitator, you recognize it. And then when it keeps coming, you get familiar with it, so you don't overreact. It's just an imitator, that's all. Actually, it's really big, it's wonderful, but it's, you don't overreact. You're familiar with it, and then you get at ease with it. So it doesn't disappear, it just stays there. Just like sometimes, like wild animals. There's people sometimes send me these little clips on YouTube, on the internet. Remember that little clip? I've actually seen it. There's a fellow, I think he brought up a lion or a tiger or something in the jungle. And then he went to the jungle again, he called out. And the lion, you know, to me it looked like the lion was attacking him. Came running up to him and then just put his arms on the guy's shoulders and started licking him or something and just playing, not harming at all, because they're best friends. And it's wonderful when you see these really, really best friends. And there was one in that little video I remember seeing, there was also this girl, and she worked in a wildlife park somewhere, but she really made friends with one of these alligators or crocodiles or whatever, this huge being. And so when she got her degree, then she jumped in the water and just showed it to a crocodile, came running up, big mouth. And, you know, the crocodile could have bit her head off, just one chop. But, you know, we'll never do that because it was a friend. They were familiar. They were at ease with one another. So it's the same with these deep meditations. So, sometimes, that these vitaka vichara, after a while, you're so familiar, you understand. Not, you can't think, I'm not going to do this, it just happens, it's just the nature. But when you get blissed out, you just leave it alone. Which means there's no vichara, no vitaka. It just stays, and that becomes the second jhana. You have confidence in the bliss, faith in it, if you like, you're at ease with it. Sampasadanang, tang chi tang. You're at ease with that. That becomes the second jhana. So that's what it is, no thought. Thought is really gross. Dear Ajahn, if material things is made of atoms, molecules, etc., as described in quantum mechanics, why then a table seems to have a surface we can touch and feel, also have textures and colours? Please explain details. That's physics. It only has a colour there because the light is on. If we turn the light off, where does the colour go? A colour is a reaction. It's not always there. Things don't have colours. It's the light shines on it. And it absorbs some light molecule, some light frequencies, and reflects others. And that's what we know as colour. Have you ever noticed material things in the world are made of atoms? No, they're not. Atoms are made of, what are atoms made of? Subatomic particles. Yeah, we always thought there was just, actually, first of all, atoms. You know what the word atom is? It's a Greek word meaning indivisible. That's apparently the ancient Greek word for indivisible, atom. The essential building block. But you know what happened? This kiwi, Lord Rutherford, split the atom. It was not indivisible. He actually split it. Wow. But there's another thing very similar. Not atom, but atama, which is a Sanskrit word for atta. Your atma, the atom. Don't they sound somewhat similar? The atom and the atma. And they are similar. Greek, Pali Sanskrit are connected. So, was Rutherford the first to split the atom? Or did
the Buddha split it 2,400 years before he did. The Buddha split the Atma, the indivisible essence of you, and realized there was nothing there. The Buddha, the great scientist. Da da da. Does that make any sense to you? Well, I don't know why you asked the question anyway. What is beyond enlightenment? Once you become enlightened, beyond that is a brown robe and a razor and a bald head to teach others. That's what's beyond enlightenment. Ajahn Brahma, if you mean what's beyond Nibbana, because there's two enlightenments. What time is it? Okay. There is what they call enlightenment, Saparidesa Nibbana and Aparidesa Nibbana. Aparisesa, sorry. Aparisesa Nibbana and Parisesa Nibbana. And the difference means is Nibbana with something remaining and Nibbana with absolutely nothing remaining. One refers to the moment you become an enlightened being, an arahat, fully enlightened, no greed, hatred, delusion, but you haven't died yet. When the Buddha became enlightened, did he die, pass away? And the Buddha, no, he taught for 45 years. And then eventually, at Kusinara, that's where, was it Aparisesa Nibbana? Nibbana with nothing remaining. That's what it means. So his five khandhas stopped and vanished. Gone. Where did they go? And that's where the Vajragotha Sutta, when somebody asks the Buddha that, when a person becomes enlightened, they die, where do they go? And the Buddha described it just, as actually said, an ordinary fire, but let's change it to a candle flame. You see a candle flame, and the flame, what is a flame? The flame is just a combination of three things, the wick, the wax, and the heat. When those three come together, there is flame. And when the wick is all burnt through, the oil or the wax is all exhausted, or the wind blows away the heat, what happens to the flame? If it's been a very good flame and warmed everybody and allowed people to read, if it's done a lot of good karma, does the flame go to a heaven realm where it can flutter forever without worrying about burning insects or using up? Or if it's been a very bad flame, like those flames over in Sydney, is it going to go to the hell realm of flames, all those flames just burn each other to bits? How crazy that is. The flame just goes out, that's all. It doesn't go anywhere, it just stops, finishes, gone. And the Buddha said the same when an enlightened being dies. Just the flame goes out. It doesn't go anywhere. All that going here, going there, stops. There's nothing there to begin with. No real flame there. Just come together with three things. So said the Buddha. Nice and simple. Oh, I never actually mentioned. You know the word for a flame going out on a candle or an oil lamp? You know what that word is when it goes out? It's called it Nibbanas. The word Nibbana was understood by kids. Mummy would say, oh, no, Johnny, you better light the candle again. The candle's Nibbana'd. Ordinary words which were used in those days for ordinary things the Buddha made use of so people could understand. Da-da-da. So, just to finish off with that simile of the candle, Elton John, he had it right. You are a candle in the wind. And you might Nibbana.
Actually, I've never heard that song. I should actually listen to something like it. Anyway, Dwajan Bhagwan said, could you give examples and explain what is meant by stream winner, once returner, non-returner, or fully enlightened being? By the way, is Donald Trump a non-returner? Well, people are hoping he's not coming back. Some people like him. What was it? I saw this. I don't know if these cartoons are still over there. I get these brilliant cartoons and I put them on the wall over there. They disappear after a while. One of those cartoons were the aliens. The aliens landed in the grounds of the White House, or just outside. And one of the aliens came out in the spacecraft and said to someone just walking his dog outside, he said, take me to your leader. That's what aliens say, apparently, take me to your leader. And he said, on one condition, you take him away with you afterwards. How are you? What's on your mind? How am I? That's a very deep question. Number one, how? What do you mean, how? Ah, the essence of being. And you? What is this you you're trying to ask about? I don't know. What's on your mind? It's not my mind. Why should there be something on it? Does that answer your question? But thanks for those weird questions, because I get all the other usual questions, so it's nice having weird ones. Dear Ajahn, throughout your journey... Whose journey? My journey? It's only present moment. Have you something... How? Have you had doubts or uncertainties about your decision to become a monk or about Buddhism? How did you resolve those doubts? Weird, but I can say I never had those doubts. Always wanted to become a Buddhist monk. Once I became a Buddhist monk, that was it. Never, ever wanted... You know, one of my best friends was a monk. He knows what this monk who he... No, another monk. Another monk who came from California, became a monk. And then, after about 3 or 4 years, he decided to disrobe. Because, you know, we were quite close, always sitting next to each other, talk to one another. And then afterwards, when he told me, he said, oh, okay, well, can't stop you. And then I went to my room and said, do I really want to ever disrobe? And I thought, you know, why do I want to be a monk? And so happy and peaceful. I'd had girlfriends, I'd had a good career and a good education. That's all I ever wanted to do, be a monk. And even also, that I don't mind telling these things, stories, when Ajahn Chakra was the abbot and he disrobed and got married. And then, you know, the Buddhist Society of West Australia asked me to take over. You know, being the teacher, the abbot of Bodhinyana. I said, oh, how long ago was that? It was about 30 years ago, wasn't it? It must have been about 25 years ago or something. Anyway, at the time, I didn't say just yes, because that wasn't in my plan. My plan was to be number two monk, because number two monk, you don't have to have any responsibility. But anyway, it didn't go as I expected. But then I thought, because I could see just the confusion when somebody who teaches and people have trust in them, when they just leave and they disrobe. So for about 2 or 3 days, I just really meditated. Ajahn Brahm, is there any chance you'll ever disrobe? If there is, just don't take on this job of being an abbot. And I looked and said, no, I can't see me ever disrobing. You know, actually, there was one possibility that I would disrobe. And that was actually not, well, every time I go in the shower, I disrobe. But apart from that, no. Anyway, so now I'm just a monk forever. Oh, until I die, obviously. Last night you mentioned there were other Buddhas before the Buddha who was enlightened when you talked about past lives. What are the other Buddhas and how do they differ from this Buddha? It's like the... Okay, you already mentioned about atoms. I usually give this story about the nature of time. What is time anyway? Because sometimes... Oh, let's actually use some of the knowledge you have about the history of our world so far. You know, about 400 or 500 years ago, people thought the earth was flat. If you got on a boat, which was really high tech in those days, and you sailed far enough, you'd fall off the edge. Because they thought the earth was flat. And so, it took some very courageous people to actually keep on sailing and come round the other end. They found the earth isn't flat. It is a limited size, but no edge to it. No beginning and no end to it. It goes round and round. So have a think of Jhana Grove here, where you're sitting. If you go east, west, south or north, and you keep on going, you come straight back here. Weird, isn't it? You're sitting in the center of the earth. Whichever way you go, you come back again. So anyway, you all know that. The earth is a globe. It's bent. So, then we went to the next dimension, space. Not just the Milky Way, the whole universe in which we live. Is there an edge to space? If you go far enough, do you fall off the edge of the universe? Or is there a wall which says the government of the universe will shoot anyone who goes past this, like they have in Singapore? You know, see these little pictures there, government property, don't go in. Well, what is at the edge of the universe? And as a kid, I remember, I used to wonder about that. And then you went to university and said, no, the universe has only got a certain size. I think it's only, what was it, 17,000 million light years. That's a radius, imagine a circle. That's its... What was it, 4/3 pi r cubed? 4/3 pi times 17 billion light years cubed. It's pretty big. But nevertheless, it's limited size. But no edge to it. Because it's curved as well. That's good old Albert Einstein noticed that the universe is not flat, it's curved. So there is no edge to this universe. No beginning, no end, but it's got no boundaries, but it's finite. Isn't that cool? But then you go to the next level. Too many people in our modern world, like these are called flat earth people, believe the earth is flat. Many people still look at time as flat timers. We think that time is also flat, which means you can go far enough and fall off its edge. You go back far enough and come to the moment of creation. Why should time be flat? Why can't, like everything else, time also be curved? Limited in extent, but without beginning. Without end. You know who first said that? When I first I read it anyway. Someone called Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha. No beginning, no end. So that's the nature of time. So many people have flat timers, having beginnings and ends. The world is not like that. It keeps on going on and on and on, round and round. Everything is round. You know, you look at the planet Earth, it's round. You know, you look at stars, they're round. Milky Way is round. The whole universe is round. Even Ajahn Brahm is round. We're all round. Anyway. Are there other Buddhas? So that's different this Buddha, different Buddhas for different times. Question. I did this the first night, I think, or somewhere recently. Can a Buddha be a female? I'll let you think about that tonight and worry about it now. Of course a Buddha can be a female, a Buddha can be a gay, could be any race, nationality or whatever. Whatever is the best incarnation to teach the Dhamma. Whatever is the most powerful. Dear Ajahn, in the sutra it is said that if a person gives food to someone who is practicing the jhana, it is of great merit. My question, the food of offering that is given before or after the receiver experiences the jhana. No, not, you can't give food to someone in a jhana. Just, they're just not there. They're just in a nice little wonderful place. But the best food to offer, and this is in the suttas, this is the word of the Buddha, I don't make these things up. He said, the food or donations or charity, you know, that type of dana, giving, the best bang for your bucks. In other words, the most return for your investment is when you give to the Sangha of monks and nuns, bhikkhus and bhikkhunis together. Many countries don't have that opportunity. Here you do. It was one of the reasons, and talking with Ajahn Brahmadi when we did the ordination of bhikkhunis, and Venerable Naroda was one of them. Ajahn Naroda now, sorry, 10 years. Over 10 years ago, it's amazing. But anyway, that once you do that, your opportunity to get good karma is immense. That's why one of the reasons to do it. Not only one of the reasons, the main reason is because why not? So anyway, that's if a person gives food to both sanghas, an offering, you're really making lots of good karma. Dear Ajahn, will mindfulness accumulate? During my meditation today, after a while, I felt a build-up of tightened area around the eyebrows. It is so almost tangible. It was nice to use that as a focus point to continue the meditation, or was it just a result of too much trying and all blood pushed there? Probably too much trying. But never, mindfulness does accumulate, then it fades away again, and it accumulates some more. And you have like peaks of mindfulness. When there's lots and lots of mindfulness, that's when all life is just so wonderful, so happy, so joyful. Whatever you see is gorgeous. And just even today, you know, just after Nicholas took me back for lunch over at Bodhinyana Monastery, just, you know, walking from your car, there's just the two trees there, which I just, oh, just never seen the bark so beautiful before. And there's, well, just what it, I would have stopped if I had to go for lunch and other people would be waiting for me, but I'll just, you see so much gorgeous stuff. I mean, even that monastery of 35 years, never seen those trees so beautiful. Or was my mindfulness very strong? Strong mindfulness, that's what happens. So there's so much beauty in the world and we just go past it, we just don't see it. But then my mindfulness was so strong, you see, it's so gorgeous. Anyway, how far on the path can you go as a layperson with a partner, i.e. not celibate? Huge way. Check it out. See how far you can go. But after a while, be a bit careful, because there was this one gentleman at the time of the Buddha, his name was Uga, and he became like a non-returner. He was a lay person, he had four wives, this Uga. And so then he, was it four or three wives? Well, three or four, but anyway, just a lot. And then afterwards he just told his wives, he said, look, now I'm a stream winner, there's no way I can sort of satisfy you sexually anymore. So, you know, I'm going to go off and become a monk. If you want to, you can become bhikkhunis, I will support you. If you want to stay in the house and, you know, I'll try and find another partner for you. If you want to go back to your families, I will support you. But it's not I don't like you, it's just I can't anymore. So when you get to be a non-returner, you know, the sexuality is just not there anymore. So he gave his three wives, the choice there. And there's just one ordained as a bhikkhuni when he ordained as a bhikkhu, and another one just went back to her family. And the third one, I think, just he found her another partner. Interesting stuff if you get enlightened. I am booking in for some past life regression therapy session. This will be my first time. Are you sure? How many sessions do I need, or is this a case-by-case basis? It's always case-by-case. But if you want to save a lot of time and money or funds, you can do that when you meditate. But you have to get deep meditations. It seems to be simpler to actually to get it through therapy, but you're never as certain that what you experience is real. And you've got to have a good therapist. And so that sometimes, you know, you get some memories of the past, and was that real? Was it not real? But then you can go and check it up by going to libraries and stuff. So, wow, that really was real. Amazing. But when you actually get into deep meditation, basically the jhanas, nimittas, I think maybe if you have a strong nimitta and come out, maybe it could work, but especially the jhanas, you come out afterwards and you ask yourself the question, what is my earliest memory? And just, I don't know why I did that, well, obviously from previous lives and stuff, but you ask yourself that question, and straight away, the image which I got, and I can't go further than this for you because breaking precepts, any sort of weird stuff or strange stuff, I'm not allowed to say. So, what came up, I was in my baby's pram, maybe about 3, 4, 5 weeks old. And the main amazing thing was, you're back there. It was like reliving sort of a past experience. Different than memories like what you had for lunch today, or, you know, where you were a month ago. This was actually re-experiencing it. It was brilliant. You can mess around and look at the colours. And that was where, I told this story many times now, that was where I realised that I recognised my mother by how she smelt. Not how she looked or how she sounded. Her smell was how I recognized even my pram and my toys. And that was weird to me because I didn't know too much about what it's like being a baby before. I never studied that. But then I told a few doctors and said, wow, that's fascinating, because according to the development of the baby, that is one of the first senses which develops, a sense of smell. And the other ones come later on. And so you recognize your surroundings by their smell, their aroma. And so, you know, always trying to be a comedian, I kept on saying to people, if you've just had a kid, make sure you don't change your scent. Don't decide, I don't like this perfume, I want something else. Otherwise, your kid won't know you. She recognizes you by how you smell. And the other thing about that, because it was just after a deep meditation, there was no doubt. I knew that was real. And that was a lovely part of it. No doubt at all. Then you say, earlier, please. And then see what happens next. Real past life. And the point is, when those things happen as a result of deep meditation, they happen automatically. There's no waiting or forcing. And it's no doubt at all. That was you. Very clear. We'd like to buy some of your books. Oh, come on, we haven't finished a retreat yet. Write your own books. Anyway, they come at the end of the retreat, apparently. Is there a chance to get them during the retreat, and can you sign them? They come at the end of the retreat, and yeah, I will sign them. Thanks, also like to get a copy of the chanting book available for purchase. Just those sorts of things, ask Christina, and you know, she will organise something for you. Dear Ajahn, can we visit your cave? Ooh. Are you ready to visit the cave? Because it's very powerful. Sometimes people go in there and, ooh, ooh. Yeah, of course you can. Yes, I think last retreat, which we had here, that I think, Burr, when she was here, she knew where it was, and so the last day of the retreat, she said, after lunch, anyone wants to go visit the cave can. So she took guided tours over there. So how many have never seen my cave? Oh, yeah, there's quite a few. Then go and have a look. So wait till the end of the retreat rather than now. Ajahn, I don't have any desire to become enlightened. It doesn't matter if you have a desire to become enlightened or not, you just do. It's not up to you, sorry. Is that force for you? Very much so. I don't mind the suffering, I like the peace and meditation, but I like to come back next lives. Well, you like to, you don't. How much of life goes according to your plans? And you think now you can change life and just plan it? Can one choose to come back if they get accidentally enlightened? No, you're finished. There we go, so it's too late. No, I'm sorry. Dear Ajahn, I find that I like doing walking meditation by walking in circles as it feels endless. Are there any ill effects of walking in circles rather than a straight line? Yeah, you get dizzy. No, it's fine. As long as it's not too small a radius. And then, so, you know, you feel nice. That's okay. No trouble at all. I'm a serial hoarder. I have a compulsion to keep things made or given by my loved ones, even sometimes asking them to make extra sentimental objects for me. Is this behavior damaging to the spiritual path? Of course it is. What are you hoarding stuff for? You know, that the simile here which comes to mind is my mother. And when I first went to see her from Australia, it's a long way, so you can't go every week. It's usually every few years at that time. So someone was very kind enough to get me, you know, like a stuffed, soft kangaroo. You know, the little toy ones you see in the shops, you know, to remind her of her son over in Perth. And she really loved that. And it was, they hit the spot. It was Australian, soft, from her son. So she put it on the shelf. You know, we had lots of other sort of mementos. So the next time, I said, okay, this time a koala bear. So I got a koala bear for her. And so she put that on the shelf. And the next time, a kookaburra. And the next time, a wombat. And the next time, I forget exactly what else I got for her. But then, she had too many little soft toys on there. She still had the first kangaroo, which I brought. And then she had them all on the shelf. And she tried to put the latest, which I think was the wombat, on there. And she couldn't fit it on. Others fell off. And then she kept on trying. When others fell off, then she tried to put them back on. And she was trying to balance everything on the shelf, which was far too small. I said, look, why don't you just the kangaroo, you've had that a long time. Throw that away. Oh, no, I can't. It's just so nice. It reminds me of my son over in Australia. I can't. Well, throw something away. Because there's not enough space on there. And she spent so much trying to balance all this stuff. It's good I didn't bring her a teddy bear, like the big one over there. You never get that anywhere. And so my poor old mother kept on so much time trying to get, you know, she wouldn't throw anything away. And I thought, that is where we have just even like nervous breakdowns sometimes. We keep so much stuff and we don't need to. I told her, look, now go and give those other ones to some charity. And just keep the latest one. That's enough to remind you of your son over in Australia. But why is it we hoard things? So you have the latest thing which someone has given you. And so you can put all your attention on the emotional value of just the latest gift. And when somebody brings you something new, you can actually send that gift away and have the new thing now as the center of your attention. You don't have to keep all of these things in your house and hoard them. Share them out. So that's how I think. That's why people do give me lots of stuff. That's why I have all these auctions to raise money for nuns' monasteries and new monasteries or something somewhere. And I'll auction everything off. It's really good fun. Even the shoes which I got, there's some Birkenstocks. They were given to me in Penang last couple of weeks ago. And the old ones were auctioned off. Really great. Well, the old ones were really, they were really comfortable. It was a sacrifice. I didn't really want to give them away, but okay, good cause. Ajahn Brahm, his roundness. I have experienced some loss, and I'm still finding it hard to recover and get used to that. Could you have any advice on this? Don't call it a loss. I don't know if it's financial loss. I think you probably mean personal loss, somebody close to you family member. If your family member dies, you haven't lost them. You've had them for so many years. So don't look at the two bad bricks in the wall, look at the good bricks in the wall. And so for me, it was a case that when my father died, had him for 16 years. It's not long enough for a young man, but he was such a good dad. I never felt sad when he died. Weird, wasn't it? 16-year-old, I never cried when he died. I felt so peaceful. I was a weird kid, I must admit. But anyway, afterwards, when I became a monk, I started thinking about that. Why? Why wasn't I sad when my dad died? And that's where I came up with the simile of the concert. I love going to concerts in London. What a great place to actually to grow up if you like music. Every type of music, the best orchestras, the best bands. But after the concert was finished, I'd be one of the first to stand up, shout, clap, ask for more, encore, more, 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 we'd shout. And the band or orchestra would carry on a little while, 10, 15 minutes. But then the encore had to finish. And the band had to go home, and I had to go home. Different ways. And I always remember London at night time. It was cold, miserable, and it was always drizzling. It couldn't even rain properly. It was not rain, not... I remember once, where was it, in something garden somewhere. They had a free concert from, they used to call themselves Jefferson Airplane then. It became Jefferson Starship or something. You know, really good rock band from the United States. And it started raining. And I was there, you know, listening to them, and just put up an umbrella. And I remember Grace Slick, I think, the lead singer. She said, "You English are amazing. It rains and you still stay there. If this was California, they'd be gone by now." I remember her saying that. It was really fun. But anyway, we loved the music, and we kept on just asking for more. When the band went, we went another way. I never felt sad. I never cried after a concert. In fact, I felt, wow, what a great music that was. And many of those memories, they stay with me. I remember the first time I was 11 years of age. I snuck in. There was a cinema, and the Rolling Stones were playing. That would be 62. And so I snuck into the cinema and watched the Rolling Stones. Only watched, I couldn't listen to them. Because all the girls were screaming, "Ah, Mick Jagger!" I hated girls then. It was true, they were spoiling the music. Oh. But anyway, it's good fun. I still remember those times. And it was all those times that I look back upon, they've all ended. I don't feel sad. How privileged I was to have a father like that, a mother to be able to listen to such stuff. I feel I haven't lost anything. I've gained. Thank you so much, Father, for being my dad. Thank you so much, whoever has gone out of your life. Thank you for being my friend, for being my partner, being my parents, my child. Thank you for coming into my life. And your body is gone, but there's so much else never goes. All those beautiful memories. Dear Ajahn, Abhidhamma is not in a sutta. Why is it taught nowadays? A very good question, because the Buddha never taught the Abhidhamma. And I said that without any explanation once. That's like BMICH. That's a big convention center up in Colombo. It was on TV as well. Said that. And afterwards the monk said, thank you for saying that. We're not allowed to say that. But they all believed it. It came a long time after the Buddha passed away. 100 years or more at least. But it's still influential. If there's any Burmese monks, and I say that, they get very upset at me. Unfortunately, it happens to be true. What do you think of writing a journal during the retreat? Not much. Why do you write a journal for? It's best actually to leave all the writing alone. Leave all of the words. Let all the words disappear. If you do write a journal, just leave empty lines. Monday, Tuesday, nothing happens. Wow. That's why sometimes people say, well, I did this retreat and I gained nothing. I say, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. People try a lot to get things and you actually got nothing? That's the best. Well done. Congratulations. So he changed the word from nothing to actually to mean everything. Sometimes I'm afraid of being alone when meditating, sleeping at night. How to overcome this? Oh, that sometimes you're meditating here in the evening, and there's a few people here. And then you'll open your eyes afterwards, they're all gone. There's always someone here. You never meditate alone. You're always here. And the energies of this room. This is one of the safest places in the world. Why? Because of all the good energies here. Amazing where this little chanting, good monks, good nuns, good lay people staying here. This is one of the safest places in the world. Sometimes people think, ah, come on, Ajahn, I'm just saying that. A few years ago, one of the disciples, they never told me what they were up to, they brought a Feng Shui master, I think over from somewhere in the Far East, over to Bodhinyana Monastery, to the main hall there. Some of you have been in there, and I recommend to meditate in there. If you can't meditate here, try over there, it's beautiful, in the main hall. And apparently, the person who took him there had to come and tell me afterwards what happened. The master came to the front of the hall. Wow! Feng Shui in this hall is incredibly powerful. In the back it's powerful, but not as powerful as the front. That hall is really strong. You know, once, to say about energies in places, once I did this 6-month retreat in one of the huts. The cave hadn't been built yet. Actually, the cave was being built while I was on this 6-month personal retreat. Well, I never, and this is absolutely honest, I never saw a human being in those 6 months. The monks would actually put food in my bowl, but they put it in a little box, and I'd go and take it afterwards, eat, wash it, and then leave it for the next day. So I never saw a human being. Lots of animals. Never talked for 6 months. Just meditated in this hut. And when I came out, apparently, many of the monks, and especially the lay people, they were just really wanted to see me because they knew that, you know, one of two things, either incredibly powerful meditation or that I was crazy. Big wide eyes and long hair. 6 months in solitude. But of course, you know, good meditations. I was happy. But the monks, they were, who is going to be the next to sit in my hut where I've been meditating for 6 months? And there was one monk, he was a German monk, and he's not here now, he's somewhere else, but he actually just, somehow or other, he won. And so he was going to move into that hut after I moved out. And the first night he was so excited, he moved in there. He couldn't get in the door. Too powerful for him. So he said, I think he rested in some other quarters for 2 or 3 days. So the energy could actually just dissipate a little bit. He could feel just those really incredible energy. So, you know, I'm a pretty powerful monk, so you're safe here. Nothing can happen to you. So, alone meditating, sleeping at night, here there's no worries at all. Money back guarantee. Because you haven't given me any money, it's just money. Dear Ajahn, during meditation, can we sense the vibes of people around us? Yep. Influence in meditation, this in turn, yeah. Especially if you... You know, that's why sometimes people say, come on, Ajahn Brahm, come and sit here more often. But yeah, are my vibes going to influence you? But how many of you are there? They influence me. Takes away my energy. So anyway, yeah, it does. Vibes of people do affect you. The last question for tonight. Dear Ajahn Brahm, please explain about boundaries in life. Life has no boundaries. It's curved. Not a flat line. When can you do this? Is it to have any or not at all? Okay, you have like your precepts, safety, those sorts of boundaries. I don't know sort of what type of boundaries you mean. But it does, you know, you look after yourself so you can look after others. Because one thing which, somebody asked me this the other day, I don't know if it was here, but no, with Ajahn Chah, that, you know, he had a stroke just after I came to Perth. People ask me just why I came to Perth, why don't I go anywhere else? You know why, and this is true, this is not a joke. I made a resolution, a promise. As soon as I decided to take Ajahn Chah as my teacher, so it doesn't matter how old I am, how many years I stay as a monk, that to make sure that I will not ask to go anywhere, Ajahn Chah can send me here and he can ask me to come back, but I myself won't ask. And so he sent me to Perth. About a month after, or maybe 2 or 3 weeks after he sent me here, he had a stroke and couldn't speak anymore. And that's why he couldn't ask me to come back. That's why I'm still here. That's true. But of course, it doesn't really matter. Wherever you go, you make a good job of it. But it's also powerful, isn't it, Perth? Why aren't there monasteries and retreat centres like this in Sydney? Or in Melbourne? Or in Queensland? Why Perth? Why have we got this beautiful Bhikkhuni monastery over in Dharamsala? What's so special about this part of Western Australia? I will now answer the question for you from science. Many, many years ago, this part of Australia was also part of India. If you look at the Australian continent, it just actually almost like fits in, just this area here, into the little, concave part of the east coast of India. And even the rock under the ground, where you're sitting, is the same type of rock as you'll find on the east coast of India. It's called Gondwana land or something. This place was connected to India a long time ago, in the time when previous Buddhas would walk in India. Maybe those previous Buddhas walked on the land in which Jhana Grove and Bodhinyana Monastery and Dharamsala now stand. They certainly didn't walk in Sydney or Melbourne or Queensland. But in this place, maybe they did. That's just a thought to leave you with for tonight. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, have a nice evening. Oh boy.